Hi everyone, welcome back to the HR Leaders Podcast. On today's episode, I'm joined by Richard Safir, who's a Chief Medical Director for Employee Health and Wellbeing at Johns Hopkins Medicine. He's also author of the book, A Cure for the Common Company, a wellbeing prescription for a happier, healthier, and more resilient workforce. During the episode, Richard shares a step-by-step roadmap to creating a culture of health on your team and in your company that keeps your people happier and more engaged. As always, before we jump into the video, make sure you hit the subscribe button, turn on the notification bell, and follow on your favorite podcast platform. With that being said, let's jump in. Rich, welcome to the show. How are you, my friend?
Great. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Nice to see you again. Where are you tuning in from today?
Tuning in from Maryland in the USA.
Nice.
Yeah.
Amazing. How's the family?
Family's pretty good. We have three kids, so there's always something going on, but we're pretty lucky. Well, you have three kids also, right?
No, not yet. I don't know if I could survive. I can barely survive one kid at the moment, if I'm being honest. Like, my mom raised four kids on her own, and I'm still to this day, you don't appreciate it as a kid, but as a parent, yeah. You're like, I don't understand how that made sense. How old are your kids?
22, 19, and 16.
Oh, cool. So they're nearly leaving home at this point.
Two are in college.
Oh, two are in college.
One's a junior in high school.
Nice. How's it feel to see them kind of leave their home and like spread their wings?
On a lot of days, it feels good because I feel very fortunate that, you know, they're good students, they're good people. And other days, you know, I have to admit, when one of your kids isn't doing well, they're having some type of struggle, it weighs on me. It weighs on my well-being.
Mm-hmm. No, I get it. Literally, last night, I've had about 2 hours sleep.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So I was on the sofa. My daughter's four. She's got the flu at the moment, and it's kind of on her chest and her throat, and she had so much congestion that she ended up throwing up because she had so much congestion. And I was up to about 5, 6 a.m. So I'm kind of,
boy.
Yeah. So it's been a crazy day and a very busy one as well. But it's no one really prepares you as a parent for, like, I get so emotional when she's sick, and my wife's my wife always like, you're overreacting, Chris. You know, kids get sick, but I get really, you know, I'm like, oh my God, like, is she okay? Like, what should we do? Yeah. And you don't really, and every time she's unwell, I can't focus on anything throughout the day apart from her health and think about how's Robin doing.
There's your parental instinct.
Yeah, exactly. So exciting times for you. Before we get into kind of what you've been recently up to, tell everyone a little bit more about your background. And your journey to where we are now.
Yeah, I studied nutrition at Cornell, and then I went to medical school. And after that, I trained in family medicine. I had thought I wanted to be a family doctor for my entire career, and I made it about a year and a half before I started to have symptoms of burnout. But back in the mid-90s, I don't think we called it burned out. In fact, we didn't talk about it. So I needed to step back and think about what I wanted going forward. And I missed some of the teaching that I had previously done and some creativity. I was fortunate to get a job on faculty at George Washington University, where I came across an article about how an employer helps support the health and well-being of their workforce. And then I just started seeking that out. And then I knew I wanted to be a company doctor, someone to help support the health and well-being of a lot of employees. And so fast forward another three jobs, and here I am at Johns Hopkins Medicine.
Wow. So that's quite a new thing, though, in general, right? Like a company doctor, like, that's still quite a relatively new.
Well, I think that the definition has evolved quite a bit, and occupational medicine has been around for decades, probably 50 years or so, and these are the folks who are looking at how the workplace and the environment impacts the physical health of the individual. So these are the folks, you know, if you're exposed to a toxin in the workplace, or there's an accident because a big block falls on your foot at a construction site. And so that's been around for a long time. But this idea that employers could possibly support and shape the well-being of their workforce is a newer concept. Although I have to say, like Johnson & Johnson back in the late 1970s really put a stake in the ground to get it started. But like most other innovations, the number of other companies that joined that journey was kind of slow up until about 20, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So how do you describe your job to people? So you're Chief Medical Director, Employee Health and Wellbeing at Johns Hopkins. You probably get a lot of people asking, what is your role? Like, how do you describe your role to people?
Sure. I mean, the one sentence is, I support the health and wellbeing of the 42,000 employees at Johns Hopkins Medicine. Mm-hmm. And I'm intentionally vague because the word support could mean a variety of things. We obviously can't do everything, but our team's goal is to create a well-being culture in our workplace so that we can support 42,000 different well-being journeys. We can't have a solution, a customized solution for each person, but we can make it easier for people to find the resources and work with the people and in a positive and upbeat environment so that it's easier for people to find or stay on their well-being path.
That's pretty amazing. And I'm seeing, especially in the last 2 years, more and more companies create roles like your own. You know, in the past, honestly, I didn't see too many. It makes sense in the industry you're in healthcare. Yes. I kind of would expect it. You would hope so, right? And obviously, Johns Hopkins, one of the most leading in this space in the world, if not the leading in the world. Was this also what inspired the book? When did that come into picture in your mind?
So I've been doing this work for about 25 years, and I've been at Hopkins for a decade. So I've learned a lot along the way. I've learned what works and, what more importantly, what doesn't. And, a few years ago, I started to realize, a lot of companies are a couple of things. A lot of companies are spending a lot of money and time trying to support their workforce, but it's not working and they're getting discouraged. And the other thing I also, came to appreciate is that teams like the one I lead, we can't do it alone. We need all managers, all leaders, all human resources, everyone to be rowing in the same direction. And so like many people during the pandemic, probably 6 to 8 months after we did a lot of hard work at Hopkins to shift our well-being strategy and how we supported our team, I had some additional time and I started to put my thoughts to paper. Mm-hmm. So it's been about a two year of physical work doing this, but I've probably been thinking about it for 7 or 8 years.
So firstly, who came up with a name? A cure for the common company. It's a pretty cool name.
I love the name. So it was a couple of things. But what it came down to was a brainstorming session with my siblings and my cousins.
Oh, nice.
We were having weekly Zoom meetings during the pandemic. And we had a brainstorming session. I got to give credit to my cousin, Debbie Feit. She's a writer. And she's very creative, and she got the final title together.
Love it. So who is this for? A cure for the common company. Who is this book aimed at?
Right. Well, the primary audience are any person who leads a team or leads in an organization. So managers, leaders, vice presidents. But human resources would really benefit from this book as well, even if they don't have someone reporting to them, because they greatly influence the employee experience. It's also good for practitioners who work at companies. So some companies are large enough to hire a health promotion specialist who runs their employee health and well-being program. Some companies are large enough to hire a doctor and they have an on-site clinic, so they treat their employees right there. So anybody in that space would also benefit from understanding this concept of how to build a well-being culture.
Mm-hmm. So break it down for our listeners, because I know in the book do you share obviously the case for building a well-being culture,
yes,
but then you also build sort of the six building blocks. So kind of break that down, then maybe we can jump into one of the building blocks.
Sure. There's this term well-being culture has been thrown around a lot. And, you know, there were a few articles in the Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine like 4 years ago that were talking about well-being culture. And it seemed to me that the authors were well-intended, but what they were really doing is talking about workplace wellness and just putting a new title to it. And so... well-being culture. Culture is the shared behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes of a group of people. And so really, culture is about these social norms and things that influence us as a group. So yeah, I have a building block framework, and the book was designed and delivered so that it's not only interesting and fun to read because there's a lot of stories, but it's very practical. And yes, it has six building blocks. There's peer support. The second is leadership engagement. The third is norms, the expected behaviors of people. The fourth, shared values. The fifth, culture connection points. And the last one that I share in the book is something called social climate. Mm-hmm. So you suggested that maybe we dive into one. Maybe we would dive into peer support.
Yes, go for it.
Just being able to talk to a coworker like you and I did, Chris, before we started this podcast, you and I shared some things about ourselves. About our health and well-being, that is peer support. But employers can be very intentional on how to create opportunities for their employees to support each other. So, for example, Microsoft has an onboarding process where they assign buddies. And so that makes it easier for the new employee to have someone to show them the ropes. It lowers their stress for sure. And it also decreases the new employee's frustration level because they have someone who they can go to who can tell them where to find the resources or how to solve a problem. So it can be as simple as the employer helping to create a buddy system, or it can be as complex as what Microsoft is doing with a software program for their employees to use to provide feedback. So Microsoft created a software program called Perspectives. When they realized that maybe feedback shouldn't just come from the manager, maybe feedback should also come from our coworkers. You know, we're often more inclined to talk to our peers than we are to talk to our boss about things. So this software program was obviously smart because Microsoft made it. It searched for all the people that the employee was working with, either emails or on meetings with. And then it sent a message to the employee, said, hey, maybe you'd want this person to give you feedback. And then that person can decide whether to send their coworker a message, and then the process starts. So, you know, simple like a buddy system, or complex like writing code and creating a software program.
I love that. I love both of those perspectives. And I'll share a story like with one of my own friends. During the pandemic, we created a Zoom call for all of our close male friends to talk about. You know, my male friends, including me, had a lot of struggle about talking about our well-being and being vulnerable. So we created a group, and we went around the group and asking, you know, what's working for you, what's not, and just sharing some tips and advice. And so talking about what you just said, I asked my friend Ben, you know, what's been the number one thing that a company's done to support your well-being? And he said, one of the things that's helped me to faster through the last 2 years is that someone on the team, I can't remember what function, just calls him, just checks in with him, just gives him a phone call once a week just to say, how are you? It's a complete stranger. Like it's the same person. I can't remember her name. It was just a while ago. And he never knew this individual, but he opened up to them and had really, you know, shared how he's feeling. And he said, you know what? I used to look forward to that call every week. And it meant so much to me that I could just have a conversation with someone that I didn't feel judged. I didn't feel, you know, like, because with your manager, it's a lot difficult, like you said, like coming to your manager or leader. But just this person, I think it was someone from within the HR team.
This episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. 2/3 of employees have 1 foot out the door in 2024. And the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
And that's just a great example to your point of just simple of just connecting and having a conversation with peers, just calling to say, how are you?
Right.
You know, that's it. Nothing else. Not performance, not just how you're getting on with your targets. Just how are you? And he said to the group, and it really stuck with me. He said it meant so much to me.
That's good. That's very good. So, you know, employers could create forums for people who may have similar experiences. So something called employee resource groups.
Yes.
So, you know, if it's a large employer that has people of different nationalities, different cultures, different religions, they might create the forum for these people who have this in common. Because, you know, there's some things happening in our communities now which are not that great. And sometimes people need the security of having a common space with people who have similar roots so that they can digest these events together.
Yeah. And then to your point about technology, I love that piece too, because I think as managers, especially managing remote teams, it's sometimes we kind of get lost in everything, and having those sort of nudge theory and having those nudges to say, hey, Chris, have you recognized Ivan this week? Or have you checked in to see how he's doing? You know, that's really helps, you know, and I think that's where technology can play a part. In connecting, like you said, or it knows that Chris is interacting with these people through different projects and sends that message out. Like you mentioned, I love that. I think that's where technology can really help us.
Yeah, you know, organizations can do this on a very little budget, or they can do it on a big budget. Mm-hmm. And if you have the budget to use technology, there are so many different options. We're all busy, and sometimes we need that reminder. And sometimes it's the reminder to check in with a teammate. Sometimes it's a reminder just to take a breath, because we're moving so fast and we're tightening up because we're stressed, and getting a breath in is something that we all need to do.
So in the book, you spoke to so many amazing leaders and organizations. What would you say one of the stories that stood out to you the most, that was the most impactful for you?
Well, the chapter on leadership engagement, you know, I talk about vulnerability and how important it is for leaders to be vulnerable and share something about themselves that they might not otherwise, because it's personal.
Yeah.
And it may show a weakness. But I talk about it because it's a well-being strategy, and people don't think of it as that. When leaders can be vulnerable, they make it easier for people on the team to also share and to ask for help, because that's something that people are a little bit reluctant to do. So when you ask me if there's a particular story, I mean, Tim Munden of Unilever, you know, strikes me as, you know, someone who really helped the folks at Unilever understand that mental health is a challenge, and that a really large portion of any company has people who are suffering from stress, anxiety, depression, and let's normalize this. But I have to tell you, Chris, Tim is not alone. There are plenty of leaders, and I give a few more examples in the book, who have been forthcoming and really have helped change the conversation inside the company walls for the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to our point before we hit record, Tim was the one who inspired me, to share my own story and journey, and because I always looked at Tim as like, and I still do,
look at Tim as someone who's amazing at what they do, you know, a kind heart, super talented. And all of a sudden I kind of heard his story and was like, wow, like you too? Because we kind of look at these high performers and assume they're invincible.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas in fact, what I realized is many of the high performers that are suffering the most. So where I saw the weakness, actually was strength in many ways.
Yeah, leaders have a disproportionately large role in the well-being of the people they lead. Mm-hmm. And the more people you lead, the more responsibility you have to be aware of how your words, your actions, and how you manage influences the well-being of those on your team.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that most leaders are trained in. It's not like you get your certificate, now you're a leader, and by the way, we're going to spend a little time showing you how to lead with well-being. And so that's really one of the main thrusts of this book, is that, you know, we get trained in how to do payroll. We get trained in how to make sure we do the software right, or how to use the machines right in a manufacturing facility. But very few people learn how to lead with well-being.
Well, what are your thoughts about well-being training? And how do we get this right? Because I've seen companies do a really bad job of it. Some do a really good job. You know, what should people be thinking about?
First, let me share with you what we're doing, and then I can kind of maybe translate that for what other companies can think about. When I started at Hopkins 10 years ago, there wasn't any specific training for managers and leaders about well-being. And about 5 years ago, we created the role of the leader in managing employee stress, because we had data to show us that, you know, the majority of our workforce was experiencing stress. And there's publicly available data to show that work is often the number one cause of stress. So we did that. That training actually became mandatory during the pandemic because of how much stress there was. We also created a crisis leadership training program 3 months into the pandemic. We released it because there's certain leadership skills that are needed during a crisis. And it doesn't have to be a pandemic that's a crisis. It could be that there was a tragic event in the community that time. There's two other trainings, Chris, but I won't go into them in detail unless we come back to it.
But break down the first training, the well-being training you mentioned. What does that consist of? Because people always talk about it, but I think a lot of our listeners are like, what does that mean? Yeah. What are you doing in those sessions? Yeah.
The role of the leader in managing employee stress is that leaders don't have to be a therapist, but we need to check in with ourselves to see how we lead. So, you know, there's multiple steps here. So the first step is to check in with yourself. How am I feeling? If I am feeling stressed, that's going to come across to the team, even if I don't think so. Like, no one can see my stress. There's something called emotional contagion, and that is the spread of emotions. And it happens amongst groups of friends. It happens within families, and it happens within teams in the workplace. And the leader's emotions are more influential than other people's emotions on the team. So if the boss comes into a meeting and they're stressed out or they're feeling hurried from the last meeting, folks on the team are going to feel that, and all of a sudden they're going to tense up. So maybe take a breath before you start, you know, you walk into a meeting with your team, just to calm yourself down. We actually do training on a breathing exercise called 4-7-8 breathing. It only takes 90 seconds, but who ever thought to train people on how to breathe? But
what is the breakdown of that? Is it 4 seconds in, hold for 7-8 out? Like, what's the
perfect?
So is that
four seconds in through the nose,
for the nose,
hold your breath, 8 seconds out through your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before doing that, though, you want to position yourself properly. You know, you have to have your body in a certain way. And you also want to repeat that for four cycles. And you know, Chris, you can you can go to YouTube and you can look it up, and it's really easy to learn. And once you have it, you can walk around with it. It's free. It's portable.
I use box breathing as well, and that really helps me when if I'm feeling anxious or you know, kind of to calm my heart rate if I'm feeling overwhelmed. I use that, and it kind of recenters me. Because otherwise, because you kind of start hyperventilating otherwise, and you get more and more anxious. Kind of that's really helped me over the years.
So one piece is checking in with yourself, self care. The second piece is management skills, like things like not micromanaging, showing appreciation, making sure you're being transparent so that people know what's going on in the company, you know, eliminating the unknown. These are the things that help lower stress levels. And so, you know, it goes through a number of these more specific items, many of which are in the book, A Cure for the Common Company, that help just ground us as leaders to say, hey, this is the minimum amount I can be doing for my team. And it's not a nice thing to do. It's a must to do, because these are the folks you work with. And when your team is feeling well, it's going to benefit your own well-being, and as well as, you know, the company's, whatever the mission of the company is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's so important. What have you found is the most effective way to deliver it? Is it groups of managers? You know, like what I'm wondering what, because they're going to kind of bounce off each other and be like, oh, I'm also feeling the same way. And, you know,
I really like the idea of doing a group meeting for that exact reason. Mm-hmm. Chris, we have something called 10 minute well-being tips for managers. It is literally a 10-minute episode of a variety of different well-being items that managers should embrace. And we have 46 episodes over the course of a year. We did it live, but we recorded them too. But in the live sessions, after the 10 minutes, we had a lot of Q&A and a lot of exchange of ideas. And people were able to help each other with their specific team challenges. By the way, those are also on YouTube. And if you just put in the search bar, 10-minute well-being tips for managers, you'll find those episodes.
Well, you've released them yourselves online.
Yeah, so it's a lot of content, and we use the YouTube server to hold it.
Nice.
We wanted,
and you made it to public as well, because it was yours.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Amazing. I'll link that in the chat. For anyone listening right now, the link's already below. I'll find it.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, that's incredible, because obviously you want to share that information with your customers and your everyone, right? Internally and externally. So it's great that you put that online for everyone.
Well, listen, it's good for everyone's well-being. People, you know, I focus on the well-being culture in the workplace, but everyone comes to work being impacted by the health and well-being of those around us, whether it's at home or someone in the grocery store. It benefits everyone when everyone's well.
You mentioned, so we've gone through kind of peer support, well-being, sort of the leadership side. What was the other core ones?
Yeah, so there's norms, the expected behaviors of a group of people. So, for example, a good behavior that a group could do is take a lunch break away from the computer. And mm-hmm. everybody either eats lunch together, because just having that social time is good for our soul, or taking a walk together. An unhealthy norm would be to eat lunch at your desk and continue working by yourself. Mm-hmm. So teams and leaders can be very intentional on how to create healthy norms for the group. And there's an exercise that, you know, we can do. You know, at the end of each of these building block chapters, Chris, I give a call-out box with some questions and some ideas for the reader to take away.
Oh, amazing. That's great. Yeah. So they can go back straight away and ask those questions and use them in a team. I love it. You just reminded me of something I used to do with my teams. I worked in quite a high-pressure sales environment, outbound sales, and it was pretty tough environment as well. And what we used to do is when I could kind of feel in when it was becoming overwhelming for the team. You know, sometimes you can just feel it. Yeah, I could see it and feel it in the room. And I was like, all right, everyone up, we're going for a walk. And it could just be like the middle of the day, and our building was huge, so kind of a walk around the block was quite a long walk. So we would just go for a walk as a team and just have a chat and reset and just forget about work for a little bit and forget about our targets, forget about how many calls we've got to make, and just go for a walk. I remember I used to get told off by the leadership team saying, what are you doing? Why are you down? Like, and I just ignore them. And I remember a lot of the other teams always used to be quite jealous that we did that. They would always bring it up and saying, I love the fact that when Chris and the team kind of feeling a bit overwhelmed, they just leave and go for a walk and come back. And we did that quite often, and it became a thing in the team, and everyone really... kind of everyone understood the value of it, even though some of the leadership team didn't get it.
Let me tell you, I love the strategy, and I love it for a lot of reasons, not just that you guys were social, you know, connecting socially and kind of decreasing the stress, but movement also helps lower stress.
Yes.
And being outside in nature helps lower stress. So you just hit on four well-being strategies, all by taking a break and having the group walk together.
And the funny thing is, right, for the business is when we got back, all of a sudden people were closing more deals.
Oh, yeah.
People more excited, more energized on the phone with clients.
Yeah.
So I couldn't prove it at the time, but I could feel it in the energy in the air. And to your point, once a month, what we used to do as well as a team is, you know, in London, East London, where we are, it's very multicultural. So my team was very, very diverse. And we used to all bring in like home cooked meals.
Yeah.
So it started with AJ, if you ever listen to this. His auntie used to make some amazing food. And we'd always be like, oh, AJ, ask your auntie to. And instead, and that used to be a bonding moment for us. So, you know, once a month, we all bring it in and we kind of have it on a huge table full of all of these different dishes and just connect over those. Great. But again, this wasn't a strategy we implemented or similar to the walk. It just felt like it was the right thing to do. I was kind of instinctively doing that as a manager. It wasn't from a playbook. It just felt like this is a great thing to do with a team.
Absolutely. Everybody needs a break. It's unfortunate that sometimes leaders or some leaders don't understand that it's not a nice to have, it's a must have. And it's not just about our own well-being. It actually will help the company. We do need breaks. Listen, if you went to the gym and lifted weights for 8 hours, don't you think that would be a problem for your muscles? So why is it that we think that we can have our brain working for 8 hours without a break?
Oh, I'm going to cut that. That's my clip for LinkedIn. Right now, I've never thought about it that way. It's so true. You know, whenever I do our big HR summits, I do like an 8-hour live stream. And I'm exhausted, and I'm physically exhausted, even though I haven't moved.
And
I try to explain it to people. Like, what do you mean you haven't moved for 8 hours? And I'm like, I can't explain it, but my body and my mind are just so exhausted because I'm on for 8 hours straight to that point. It does feel like I've been lifting weights for that long as well. So yeah, it's so important to do that. What are some of your other favorite parts of the book do you think our audience, especially the HR leaders, can benefit from?
Well, I like that there's a mixture of stories about Hopkins. There's a mixture of stories about other companies. I share a little bit about my own health and well-being journey. And all throughout, though, it's based on social sciences. You know, I kind of am an academic at heart on one hand, but I really want it to be entertaining and understandable on the other hand, because I'm also an avid reader. And so you can know that when you're reading this, what I'm sharing is referenced and that you can feel confident that these are strategies that have been proven to be helpful and effective. Mm-hmm.
If you had to choose kind of one strategy that our audience should go away and do and implement with their team straight away, what would you choose?
Put well-being on the agenda. So what that means is if your team has a regularly standing meeting, make sure that well-being is always on the agenda. And that will force you as a leader to think about what are we going to talk about or what are we going to do this week when we get to the well-being part of the agenda. It could be that we do a 5-minute breathing exercise, or it could be that we talk about a resource that's available in the at work, or it could be we go around the room and say what we're grateful for that's work-related. Whatever it is, if you put well-being on the agenda, it automatically causes you
to think about
think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, it might be out of sight, out of mind.
It also sheds a clear signal to your team that this is a priority. You know, we're not just saying it to tick a box or, you know, literally it's on the agenda. That sends a very clear signal to the team.
Absolutely. I talk about this as in the book in two ways. One, I talk about the leader's role in making sure that well-being is a priority, and also prioritizing as a well-being strategy. That's something that we don't, you know, many people don't do well. And the fact that a lot of employees feel like they've got 10 things to do at the same time and they don't know which is the most important is a problem.
It's true.
It makes us feel unwell. Mm-hmm. So one strategy, there's so many strategies, Chris. I mean, one strategy really is to get good at prioritizing.
Mm.
And to regularly be checking in, what are my top three priorities, so that you feel grounded and not like you're like swimming in this huge ocean and not knowing which way the land is.
I get like I love that one because it sounds, people have probably heard that 1,000 times, but still don't do it. Like for me, I have my checklist every day and I don't know the science, but I feel like at the end of the day, I have like endorphins when I complete that list.
Absolutely. When you accomplish something, it feels good. You release dopamine.
Then
you want to do it again.
Yeah, exactly. I always write it down and I do it and I'm like, oh, it's great. It's done. and you get work done, right? So you're kind of winning on both sides. You're getting the work done, but you get that sense of achievement every day. Even if it's the smallest of tasks, I feel like I've achieved something today. Today as well. Listen, we're not going to give the whole book away, so people have to grab a copy to read it. But before I let you go, where can people connect with you personally if they want to reach out? And then where can they grab a copy of the book?
So they can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active. You can learn more about the well-being culture framework. I also have richardsafir.com if you just want a big dose of me, maybe not. And then books are available anywhere books are sold. I obviously recommend that you read it. And I think once you read it, you're going to realize you're going to want your other leaders to read it. Because, Chris, as we spoke before, there's a lot of good ideas in this book, but it's going to be really helpful to brainstorm with your colleagues to figure out how specifically this might apply to your organization.
Yeah. I absolutely love that. And I think now more than ever, we need to have this information in the hands of our leaders and or everyone, not just at work, but also just for society as a whole as well. So I appreciate all the work you're doing. Super excited for everyone to read the book. And if everyone listening, all of those links are below. So wherever you're watching or listening to the show right now, there'll be a link to connect with Rich and grab a copy of the book in the description. So make sure you do that. And Rich, I wish you all the best until we next speak.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Chris.
Great.
Have a great day.